Today, as the coronavirus continues to spread worldwide, we look at how the Chinese government is trying to control it. And a story of hope amidst the conflict in Yemen.
I had been looking for families that had been affected by the virus in Wuhan, and myself and a colleague found a young woman named Liu Mengdi who is studying in Italy.
Lily Kuo is the Guardian's Beijing bureau chief, and the woman she's talking about has been watching from where she is at university in Italy as her family in Wuhan has contracted coronavirus.
You know, she describes her family like frantically calling, going through the process that they've been told to follow to get help. So
first, her grandfather got ill and her family found it impossible to get him any treatment.
And so they're calling these people and then they say, oh, either don't answer the phone or they don't give them any advice. Finally, she goes online and starts posting things and then gets in touch with local media. And then once her story is out of what's happening to their family, then local health workers come and see her grandfather. It's too late, and he dies the next day.
Now she's fighting to save her father, who has also contracted the virus.
And what's very sad about her father's case is that he's in his 50s, but Liu said that everybody always thinks he looks like he's in his 40s.
What has made Liu angry is not only the lack of treatment, but also that she's been told to only write positive things about the virus online. And earlier this month, her WeChat account was suspended. She suspects because she was posting about how her family has been affected.
But now he's in a really bad state.
Like many other Chinese people, she is frustrated at how their government has handled a virus that has killed thousands and is now spreading rapidly around the world with recent outbreaks in Iran and Italy.
Italy restricts the movement of tens of thousands of people in towns near Milan and Venice to battle the virus.
More drastic measures in Italy as doctors struggle to contain the spread of the coronavirus.
50 people have now died from the coronavirus as the infection spreads across the Middle East.
Our window of opportunity is narrowing. If we squander the opportunity, there will be a serious problem in our hands.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, can China's government control the coronavirus?
May I have a guest name, please?
It would be Lily Kuo.
All right, just a moment. I'll put you through to the room. Hold the line, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I called Lily at her hotel in Hong Kong.
Hello?
Hello, is that Lily?
Yes.
Hi, Lily. This is Rachel Humphreys calling at the Guardian's Today in Focus podcast. How are you?
How's it going?
Let's go back to December last year when Chinese authorities first alerted the World Health Organization to several cases of what was called unusual pneumonia in Wuhan at the time. It seemed like Chinese officials responded very quickly at first to this, didn't it?
So at the beginning, public health experts and observers were applauding the Chinese response to the virus. By the end of December, they had reported this unknown pneumonia to the WHO.
Authorities have reported 27 cases in total, seven of which are critical.
By the next day, they had shut down this seafood market that they suspected to be linked to the outbreak.
Authorities in Wuhan have ordered a local seafood market with apparent connections to the outbreak to shut down.
They said there was no reason to suspect the virus was transmitted through humans.
But then it wasn't until January 20th that Chinese health officials really sounded any kind of real alarm about the outbreak.
The spread of the coronavirus is accelerating.
Nationwide, measures are being put into place on airplanes, trains, and buses to detect infected people.
It comes as hundreds of millions of people prepare to travel home or abroad for Chinese New Year.
And so, and even in the days leading up to the lockdown, they'd handed out tickets to people to come visit the city, free tickets to tourist sites.
People were being encouraged to go to the infected area, essentially.
Right. The city of Wuhan was encouraging people from other areas within the province to come and visit the provincial capital.
Wuhan, 加油!
The city had hosted a banquet that had 40,000 people come. And so I think part of what people are angry about is the fact that all of that was still going on when clearly there was a more serious outbreak happening. And in December and January, tens of millions of people are traveling across the country to go to their hometowns to celebrate Chinese New Year. So by the time that authorities had put the city of Wuhan, of 11 million people, almost on complete lockdown, most people had already started that journey. So that's a lot of people that are all across the country now and in other parts of the world.
And you were in Beijing when this was all happening. When did you and other people around you get the sense that actually this virus was perhaps a lot more serious than initially thought?
As the situation was developing, there were cases in Wuhan, and then there were cases in Thailand, and then there was a few other countries where there were cases, and people were joking, is this virus a patriotic virus? It only affects people who go abroad, and why aren't there other cases in China? That weekend, there were some media in Hong Kong that started to report that there were cases elsewhere in China, and then Chinese officials started to say, okay, wait, actually.
Unconfirmed pictures from inside a hospital showing it overwhelmed. Patients treated in corridors, all medical staff in full protection suits. One doctor has already died.
So was there a sense as well at this point that you weren't getting the full story about what was happening?
There is always that suspicion based on past experiences that the Chinese public has gone through where officials don't disclose everything that's happening. When SARS happened, there was a deliberate cover-up at the beginning. But in this case, it might be more a case of mishandling. Although there have been studies that show that there were clearly cases of human-to-human transmission as early as mid-December.
That's important because at this point, some Chinese authorities were still disputing that the virus was spreading through human contact. How is this all being made perhaps more complicated by rumours on social media?
That lack of trust means that people are turning to other sources of information to try to figure out what's going on. And so people are doubly anxious because they don't always trust the information that their government is giving them. And then they're also reading rumors on WeChat and Weibo. There was an official who got infected, and he said that it was because he wasn't wearing goggles. And suddenly goggles are sold out and everybody's wearing goggles.
When did you get the sense that you needed to leave?
So I left before the quarantine measures started in Hong Kong that required that anybody who came from mainland China would have to be quarantined for 14 days. The logistics of being in Beijing, and it was a really suffocating place to be at the time because you were inside all the time and the restrictions kept changing and getting worse. I was getting more nervous, not so much about the virus, but about what the authorities were going to do and what kind of restrictions were going to be placed on us. And then if you're kind of stuck inside a place and the virus does get worse, then what do you do?
And it appears that the government has been using force against people who don't follow their rules on trying to contain the spread of the virus.
Yes. Yeah, so there's been a lot of videos and posts about basically local officials going too far. So chaining a man to a pole because he wasn't wearing a face mask or he wasn't following directions. Or an elderly woman who says she can't afford to buy a face mask and then she ends up getting pinned to the ground.
God, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's not just the virus that's terrifying, it's how the authorities are responding to it.
In the first few weeks after the virus outbreak was announced, where was President Xi Jinping?
In the first few weeks, he only had two public appearances, and they're both pretty brief. So he met with the director of the World Health Organization in Beijing.
对中国人民来说，我们现在正在进行着一场严肃的斗争。中国政府呢是高度重视。
And then I think he also had a state visit with the Cambodian prime minister. And it's very abnormal for a leader like Xi, whose face is everywhere in state media, and for him to not be at the center of this was really curious. And in the early weeks, he had his premier go down to Wuhan, and he didn't. And that started to shift a little bit recently. So we have the photo ops of Xi.
在接下来我们的疫情战斗中，社区管理防控，这是一个基础。
Visiting a neighborhood and a hospital in Beijing and talking to health workers over a video and cheering for the people's war against the virus to be won.
Upon arrival at a hospital in Beijing, the Chinese president allowed his temperature to be taken before inspecting the new measures put in place to stop the spread of the coronavirus.
It's unclear how quickly Xi really did respond, because an internal government speech that's now emerged suggests he knew about it long before he started appearing in front of the media and doctors.
The speech comes out to show that Xi is actually in charge and he is personally commanding the response to the virus. But in that speech, it shows that he was giving instructions on the response on January 7th. But it wasn't until January 23rd when they started to put into place quarantine measures in Hubei.
One person who has come to symbolise the struggle between the Chinese government and the Chinese people is Dr. Li. Tell me about him.
He's become sort of a folk hero in China, and people are comparing him to the doctor who exposed SARS during the SARS outbreak.
A shrine to Dr. Li Wenliang outside the hospital where he died, a martyr to telling the truth.
Dr. Li was an ophthalmologist. He worked at Wuhan Central Hospital, which is one of the hospitals that has had a lot of patients from the virus. And so in late December, he sent a message to a private group of colleagues saying that he knew that there were 7 people that were in quarantine. At first, he described it as SARS. So he thought that it was a return to SARS, but then he corrected his statement and said, oh no, it's a SARS-like virus. He had sent a message saying people should wear protective equipment and trying to advise his friends and colleagues to protect themselves.
He's willing to speak up the truth. And unluckily, the truth was not spread around early.
He was visited by public security a few days later. He was accused of spreading rumors, which is a crime. And so he signed a statement saying that he wouldn't do this anymore.
He himself contracted coronavirus. Do we know how?
He treated a patient, I think an 82-year-old woman, who did not show any symptoms. But then he started to experience the symptoms. He sent his child and his wife, who was pregnant, away and quarantined himself. And then finally, January 30th, he was confirmed as positive for the virus.
And then on February the 6th, Chinese state media reported that Dr. Li had died. And there was this overwhelming response, it seemed, around the world to this news.
He became a public figure and sort of a hero in people's eyes as a regular person who was trying to speak out and, you know, pushing against the system.
Dr. Li will be remembered as a hero for his contribution to the fight of this disease.
He's the hero of China. I'm so proud of him.
How did state media report on his death?
There was a statement that he wasn't dead, that he was in critical condition and that he'd been put on life support. And then finally, I think state media declared that he had died at 2:58 in the morning, technically on Friday. But earlier reports were that his heart had stopped at around 9:30 p.m. on February 6th on Thursday.
So they may have sort of tried to make it look like he was still alive because they didn't want people to be upset and angry, perhaps.
Yeah, and the response kind of as soon as those reports started coming in were overwhelming. The anger, the mourning, you know, Chinese social media gets censored a lot, but there was no way of censoring this because it was just so much.
On Chinese social media, millions expressed their grief and anger.
With memes about how he'd been gagged, the people's hero, a whistleblower. Others saying Chinese people wake up with the hashtag we demand freedom of speech.
It was something for people to focus and channel their anger about how this virus has been able to spread and how it's affected so many people. And there are a few other doctors who have come out and said, you know, I was disciplined for posting things or saying things.
How has the Chinese government been trying to contain how the media reports on the coronavirus more widely?
So there seems to be a real effort from state media to tell positive stories. So the stories seem to focus a lot on moving, emotional tales of people that are sacrificing to try to help fight the virus. One that I saw recently was a video of a woman who was 9 months pregnant who every day is still going to the hospital and treating patients and, you know, she's at the front line, she's not giving up. But some of these seem a little bit tone deaf. I mean, it's horrible that a woman who is 9 months pregnant should still be, why does she need to be still working? Are there not enough doctors that she still needs to be there? They've been criticized and kind of made fun of also, some of these efforts.
How are Chinese people feeling about that?
So I would say that most Chinese people are used to the censorship and the restrictions that there are. So if you want to look at the New York Times or the Guardian or YouTube or Facebook, you have to have a VPN to get around the Great Firewall. But there's so much content, you know, on the Chinese internet that you don't really, you know, most people don't even bother doing that. So that's why it's so interesting to see people respond and say, we want freedom of speech, because that isn't something that mainstream Chinese people really care, seem to care a lot about.
The limiting of freedom of speech, how has that extended to the media?
Last week, Chinese authorities expelled three Wall Street Journal reporters. It's an unprecedented retaliation against foreign journalists. And I think it's been 2 decades since any foreign reporter was expelled.
How did the government justify that?
The stated reason from the foreign ministry is that the Wall Street Journal wrote an editorial that described China as the sick man of Asia.
And some people see that as a racially prejudiced term that was used to denigrate China many years ago.
The Wall Street Journal has justified the term as describing China's governance and that there's no racial overtones to that. Even so, even the three reporters that have been expelled, they have nothing to do with that editorial. Again, the day after they announced their expulsion, the foreign ministry said, you know, we're not interested in the Wall Street Journal's division of labor, and media outlets that smear China have to pay the price. The three of them have all reported extensively on allegations of human rights abuses in Xinjiang. And one of the reporters is in Wuhan now, and she is one of the few reporters that has been in Wuhan reporting on how the government has been handling the situation. On she's reported on the lack of supplies and capacity, and it seems to be very much aimed at that reporting.
Lily, you report for a foreign newspaper too, and you've been covering this story. What's that been like for you?
Yeah, I think it makes all foreign journalists in China worried, and the level of harassment and surveillance has been getting worse for foreign journalists and also for Chinese journalists over the last few years. So every foreign journalist that works in China is pretty much always thinking about, is their visa going to get renewed? How much longer are they going to have here? And it's, you know, it's a difficult thing if you built your career kind of around reporting on China. And then for Chinese journalists, they're always thinking about, could they be detained or what could happen to them if they get on the wrong side? And so what is worrying is when we're doing our work is how everybody that we talk to is kind of at risk. And for us, it also creates more anxiety about the danger that the people that we speak to and who tell us their stories, that they might be putting themselves in.
Xi Jinping has been criticized for his absence. And the other week, a law professor called Xu Zhongrin made the bold decision to post articles online damning the government. What did he say in them?
In his essays, he never refers to Xi by his name, but it's clear that it's Xi. He says, you know, the spread of the virus has revealed the rotten core of Chinese governance. And it's interesting, his comments, because in one of the speeches by Xi a few weeks ago, he says that this outbreak is a test of the Chinese governance system. It's a test of Chinese capabilities. And this essay by this academic is saying that it is a test and it's revealed the rotten core of that governance system.
So actually his language in that is incredibly strong.
Right. And he blames the virus on a culture of suppression and systemic impotence that Xi personally has created.
It seems remarkable that he continued to make these points. He was put under house arrest and had his internet cut off. But last week, there were reports that he'd made contact with friends.
He had previously been suspended from his position at his university. So it's quite incredible that he continues to speak out.
Xi has gained a reputation for censoring the information available to people in China. How does the way that he's handled this outbreak sort of fit with his approach to leadership more broadly?
So the ramping up of censorship and draconian measures and limiting people's freedom of movement and threatening punishment for both citizens and government officials for stepping out of line fits into this culture that has been created under Xi. Several high-level officials of Hubei province have been fired. Lots of others have been disciplined or punished in some way. There's been a lot of language about everybody needs to obey the central government.
Is there a sense here where the central government is putting the blame and the attention on local governments almost to shift the narrative?
Right, to shift the narrative and shift the blame and say, and it also was a way to show, you know, the crisis got out of hand because the local officials didn't handle it, but we, the central government, led by Xi Jinping, were stepping in.
Over the weekend, Xi Jinping made a speech and reassured the public that the virus would be contained, and parts of China are trying to return to normal. But is there any sign that that might be possible soon?
So one thing that people say is to pay attention not to what the government says, but what they do. So over the weekend, President Xi Jinping gave this major speech, and he described the epidemic right now as severe and complex and a major test for China. But at the same time, he said that it was controllable and that any impacts on the economy and China's development would be short-term, and again, something that the government can handle. These assurances don't seem to match up with the actions. So on Monday, we saw that the party passed a measure to delay an annual parliamentary meeting, which is a major political event every year. It was supposed to happen in early March. The fact that they have delayed it shows that the outbreak is still pretty far from being contained.
In some cities in China, are people starting to go back to work? Are streets looking more full? Are cities starting to return to normal?
So some cities are making an effort to return to some form of normalcy. So in Beijing and Shanghai, you are seeing more people on the streets, more people going back to work. But a lot of people are still working from home. A lot of people who were gone over the Chinese New Year holiday have still not come back.
How is this affecting the Chinese economy?
First, over the national holiday, you had a drop in spending that normally happens around that time. And then on top of that, you had the holiday extended. And even though that holiday has officially ended, a lot of businesses and factories are still shut. You know, Xi Jinping said in his speech over the weekend that the economy is going to be fine, it's short term. China can still meet its development goals for the year. By the end of 2020, China is supposed to have eradicated poverty. So there's these very ambitious goals. And you can tell that the government is very anxious about it because they keep saying it's going to be fine.
Yes, and I'm sure they must be very anxious because having a strong economy is vital to keeping the political system stable in China.
I mean, the Communist Party's hold and their legitimacy in the country really depends on the economy doing well and people feeling like their lives are getting better and people feeling like they have opportunities. So a lot of people that we've spoken to, some people said, at this point, I'm not scared of getting the virus. I'm scared that my business is going to go under or my employer or my clients aren't going to need my work. And it's already affected people's confidence in the government. You know, some people have described this as China's Chernobyl moment. It doesn't necessarily cause a change right away, but it plants a seed where people's faith in the government and the competence of the Chinese Communist Party to take care of them and handle things has been severely damaged. And in the long run, that's when we'll see how that plays out.
You described it as a Chernobyl moment in reference to the way the Soviet leadership covered up the true impact of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Some argue ultimately led to the downfall of that administration. But you think a downfall of the administration in China would take a lot more than what we're seeing at the moment?
In terms of like challenges to Xi's legitimacy or mandate to lead, it's been a very difficult year and a half or so. You have the protests in Hong Kong, and they're kind of on hold right now because of the virus. Everybody described that as the biggest challenge to the Chinese leadership since Tiananmen. And I would say that the virus is even bigger than that because it has made Chinese people very upset and very angry. It is too early to say whether or not it rises to that level of people actually going out to the streets. And I think we can't underestimate the extent that Xi and the Communist Party have cemented their hold and their power over the country.
Lily, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Lily Kuo. You can read all of her reporting on the spread of coronavirus in China and around the world at theguardian.com. Coming up, a humanitarian breakthrough in Yemen's five-year conflict.
Too often in science podcasts, we hear voices not of the people who might be affected by new discoveries, but of those who made them. What if we flip that on its head?
My daughter's got an itch chromosome, and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her. It's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
With our Common Threads podcast, we travelled around the country to hear people's questions, hopes and fears when it comes to something called gene editing.
I'd say that he's very happy in his skin. The only person that has suffered because of him is me.
To have a listen, Just search Common Threads on your podcast app.
Now, in Yemen, a civil war between Houthi rebels and the government has led to a blockade of the country and the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today. Thousands of people can't access proper medical care, but there's a small sign of hope. This month, some Yemenis have been able to leave the country for urgent treatment on so-called mercy flights. The Guardian's international correspondent, Michael Safi, has met some of them in Jordan.
Imagine you have a daughter and she breaks her arm and you take her to the doctor and he says, look, we can easily treat this, but we can't do it in this country. We don't have the equipment. And the only way she can get treatment is to fly overseas, except that's not possible either. And so actually, there's nothing we can do about it. For hundreds of thousands of people in Yemen, that's the reality. Many parts of Yemen are subject to a blockade. No civilian flights can get in and out. They're just stuck. And so the smallest injuries, the most minor illnesses, can become something seriously life-threatening really quickly. Early in February, an unusual flight left the city of Sana'a. Unusual for a couple of reasons. One, because no civilian flight has left Sana'a in 3 years. And second, because this one was carrying 8 kids in need of urgent treatment overseas. It was headed for the Jordanian capital, Amman. Among the kids on the plane was a 5-year-old girl called Manal. Before she was 2, her brother was playing with her one day and he got a bit rough and she hurt her shoulder. At first, her parents didn't know how bad it was until they noticed after a few weeks she had just stopped using it. It just hung there limply. And so her dad, Abdullah, took her to a few doctors and they said she needed a kind of surgery that wasn't available in Yemen. And so the injury was never treated. Her right arm stayed the same size while her left arm grew. And her father said that he started to turn away from Manal when she was being bathed or dressed. I couldn't stand the sight of her, he told me. It broke my heart. Last October, they were given good news that the UN had negotiated for them to be flown out of Sana'a for treatment. And so Manal and her family went to a hotel in the capital and waited for the flight. And at the last minute, they were told it was off, that the entire plan had been postponed, and not for the first time. For months, these sick kids waited in a hotel in Sana'a for the opportunity to fly out of the city and get treatment. Getting these kids into surgery seems like it would be a no-brainer, but it's actually taken more than 18 months of negotiations. And when I talked to people familiar with those negotiations, I could hear the frustration in their voices that it had taken so long. You know, they said that every time the negotiations broke down, people who should have been receiving care died. I was told that the parties in these negotiations argued over everything, over who would get to choose the patients who got out, what kind of plane they would fly out on, where they would go, which airport they would return from. And it just came down to this question of sovereignty. The official Yemeni government didn't want to let a civilian flight leave Sana'a because, in their view, that would legitimize the Houthi government. And the Houthis wouldn't let the sick kids leave through Aden, a city that the Yemeni government controls, because then they were acknowledging they weren't a sovereign government. And then there was the matter of actually flying a civilian plane into a war zone. This whole load of technical issues. And as they were working this out, parents were trying to keep their kids alive. I had a chance to meet some of these kids at a pediatric unit in Amman. The walls of the unit were really colourful. They were covered in Disney characters. And there was a real atmosphere of relief in the rooms that I visited. And then we met a young guy called Ayman who couldn't stop grinning. And it was the kind of grin that when he smiled, everyone in the room couldn't help but also smile. We were talking to his dad and he was finishing answers and shouting contributions. And then we thought, okay, well, now it's time to interview you. And we sat with him. And of course, he got really shy. And whenever he would talk, he would start panting and get tired really quickly. And I realized later that was because of his condition. His spine has been curved into a sort of subtle S shape and it crushes his lungs. And so he can't speak very long without tiring himself out. And it had been that way for 4 years. And he was finally lined up for the surgery that would help him to breathe properly, to talk properly and be able to run like the other kids. It was a really rare moment of joy in a conflict that's had very few of them.
That was Michael Safi. You can read his full story on the website. Thanks to him and Lily Kuo. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Kakoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Anushka will be back with you tomorrow.